Come to Solarfest in Brandon, Vermont, as it celebrates its 30th anniversary on August 8th, 9th, and 10th. Education, environmental activism, and multiple workshops combined with main stage performances by the Bo Thayer Band, Ray Vega, The Mammals, Zach Nugent, Dead Set, and many more. There will also be an Under the Stars documentary screening of Far Out, Life On and After the Commune on Friday night. More information and tickets at solarfest.org. WFVR is a media sponsor of Solarfest. Well, good morning and welcome to Green Zine here at Free Vermont Radio, WFVR-LP in South Royalton, Vermont. This show airs live every Thursday for the last 12-plus years from high atop Magic Mountain in South Royalton. I think he's fixed his flat tire, and he is on his way, and we're expecting to have a visit with two guests today. Coming up first, Sam Dixon, who is the farm manager up at Shelburne Farms, and then someone that I know quite well from Solarfest, the executive director, Michael Bailey, due to join us in the second half hour. Right now, listening to a little bit of music from Alistair Fraser from a compilation of great Scottish music that Carl Newman has donated to the studio. Of course, you can hear Carl every Wednesday with the Wednesday Breakfast Club from 7 to 10 a.m. and an extra dose of Carl this weekend as we start a rotating schedule of hosts for One Planet Groove. Long-term host of that show, Tim Murphy, stepping back. And Carl Newman will be coming in on August 3rd to cover that. Let's let this music go a little bit more. Actually, you know what? I'm going to do a little segue here of music. Get this ready. Bring this down. We'll have all kinds of news for you coming up, but the Mammals are appearing, as you heard in that promo, out at Solarfest next weekend. And actually, during this piece of music, be a good chance, if you've been wondering about Solarfest and what it's like and don't know whether you can make the commitment, it's over in Brandon, Vermont, just under an hour from South Royalton. Music, environmental education, a good time with hanging with the tribe, people that want to lower the carbon footprint. All the power there is supplied by solar energy. I was over there yesterday doing some stuff and also charging up my EV because they've got some EV charging there as well. So lots of things going on at Solarfest. We'll find out more about the workshops and the music and everything else. There is camping available for the first time this year. The event does happen starting on Friday with workshops at 1 o'clock, Friday the 8th of August. On the 9th of August, all kinds of workshops, singer-songwriter contest. Bo Thayer, who's a local around here, will be performing. Zach Nugent, Dead Set. And this band will also be on Saturday. So let's hear from The Mammals and a environmental song called Sunshiner.
Yes, my daddy. My daddy was
She said something about geothermal. She gave me a hard hat, said make yourself useful.
I can't think of a more appropriate song for this weekly environmental show. That was The Mammals. Hopefully they'll break that out at Solar Fest coming up next weekend. And somehow changing the tire and still getting here pretty much on time, my colleague Henry Swayze in the studio. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning.
Yes. Did you get a good workout?
No, I tapped into my partner's brand new car that had a flat fixer in it, a pump.
It seals it. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was an electric one, but all I could get to do was to pump the goop into the tire and not add any air. So I went headed out, and I went back home and tried that, and then I had to get a hand pump out. So I pumped it up enough with a bicycle pump to get to the first filling station, and paid $1.50 for air, and it would only take my tire up to 27 pounds pressure.
So your car is steadily leaking right now out in the parking lot?
I think that goop might have fixed
it. The goop might have set up.
But there probably is a nail in it. I've looked at it twice trying to figure out where it is.
All right. Well,
anyway, so that's all that.
We're glad you got here because it's hard to do the show without you.
So let's do bird note.
Yeah,
because otherwise,
we're going to be talking to. I lined up one of our guests, and you lined up Sam Dixon, who's going to join us very shortly.
So, farm manager from Shelburne Farms.
Right. Well, I'm looking at. I really like Aldo Leopold, so I'm glad that you chose this bird note. It's called July Before Dawn, Aldo Leopold. Let's take a listen to bird note here on Royalton Community Radio's Green Zine.
This is Bird Note. A sweetly whistled song speeds toward a melodious trill. It's still dark, an hour before dawn on this July morning in the Wisconsin countryside. A field sparrow announces the new day. This was the first bird song Aldo Leopold awoke to on his farm in the 1940s. In his Sand County Almanac, a classic of conservation and nature writing, Aldo Leopold brought to life scenes of nature a month at a time. Picture a man sitting on a bench outside his cabin door, awaiting the dawn chorus, a cup of coffee in hand, facing, as Leopold put it, the white wake of the morning star. He wrote, "Before the field sparrows have quite gone the rounds, the robin in the big elm warbles loudly his claim to the spot in the old tree." The robin's insistent caroling awakens the oriole. Then the indigo bunting. And so it goes. Field sparrows aren't as common today as they were in Aldo Leopold's day, but conservation of natural grasslands can help boost their numbers. And the Federal Conservation Reserve Program is leading the way, helping to maintain the ideal habitat for these sweet singers. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Well, that was a nice bird note. Several bird calls that I hear around here. Although the field sparrow, I'm not sure. Do we have lots of field sparrows here?
I have never heard one. They may be here. I haven't researched it to find out if they're here, but it's not one I'm familiar with.
Well, someone who I think is here, Henry, the phone just gave a little ring, and we might be able to bring our guest right up if you think that's appropriate, or do you want to cover something else first?
No, is that you, Sam?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. So we've told people that you are going to be on the air and that you are farm manager for Shelburne Farms. But other than that, they don't know nothing. So, Sam, tell us a little bit about you and then kind of what the grand overview for Shelburne Farms is and what the goals are.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll start with just a little bit of introduction. Yeah, my name's Sam Dixon. I'm the dairy farm manager here at Shelburne Farms. I've been here since 1996. Had the great opportunity to manage this wonderful farm here at Shelburne Farms. I'm not sure if your listeners have visited here, but I'll just give a little overview of the farm. We're a 1,500-acre farm right on Lake Champlain in the town of Shelburne on the former Webb family estate. We're currently a 501c3 not-for-profit educational institution, also on the National Historic Register for the landscape and the buildings. We have a working farm here, which I manage, milk up to 120 purebred registered brown Swiss, make cheddar cheese on the farm, and also have an inn and restaurant and a lot of educational programming. Just if I could toot our horn a little bit, we did receive a first prize from the American Cheese Society for our one-year cheddar at their recent annual meeting, which we're very proud of.
Whoa.
Well, you should be. Hey, is that also the location of a summer concert series there at Shelburne Farm?
Well, we used to have we've done a lot of things over the past, but we have a town concert series on Wednesday night in the courtyard of the farm barn, and that's in cooperation with the town of Shelburne. Our main mission is educating and educating for a sustainable future. We have a global reach. I think we was just looking through the annual report last week, and we either had people come here or serve people. About 182,000 people last year used the resources of Shelburne Farms. So our main mission here is education, but we also have the working farm as a resource to help with those educational programs. We have an in-and restaurant and a variety of various programs here, field trips and a whole manner of activities. And I just encourage anybody to go to our website to see what's going on, because there's always a lot of stuff going on here. But I met Henry a couple weeks ago at an extension event here, and we were talking about carbon and climate change, and we started discussing our climate action plan here on the farm, and I think that's what we're going to dive into here.
Yeah. So the farm has set a very aggressive goal for itself.
Yeah, our climate action plan is to be at carbon drawdown, not just carbon neutral, but carbon drawdown by 2028.
Ooh.
So that's three years.
So explain that difference. Get that nuance of what the difference between carbon neutral and carbon drawdown is.
So carbon neutral would be the organ, and we're talking organization wide. So this is across the organization, not just the farming activities, but all of the other things that go on here. So carbon neutral would be we're sequestering as much carbon on the farm as we're emitting. So that's at zero. And drawdown is where you're actually below that level. So you're sequestering more carbon on the farm than you're using. So you're pulling carbon out of the atmosphere and storing it here on the farm.
So you're making up for the rest of us naughty folk.
Yeah. Well,
not all of us.
in one way you could look at it like that. It's an ambitious goal, and like I said, it's organization wide. So it's not just the dairy. And so we've done things like changed heating sources in buildings. We have a lot of solar panels on the farm. It really helps that we buy a lot of our electricity from Green Mountain Power, and they can, you know, many of their sources are what would be called, you know, green sources, Hydro-Quebec, and I mean, you can argue about the nuances of the various sources, but they're not burning fossil fuels. Also, we've done things like switched for our grounds crew and our maintenance. They're all using electric lawn mowers and electric, you know, string trimmers and things like that to reduce fuel use in that department. And then changing the heating systems in the buildings. We're just wrapping up a major renovation of the coach barn, which is an event space and will be where the Center for Sustainable Schools will be located. And we put a geothermal heat system in there. Actually, the house that I live in was built 10 years ago. We don't burn a drop of fossil fuel in this house. All the heat and hot water comes from wood that's cut and on the farm here. So we're looking across the organization on how we can, you know, reduce our fossil fuel use and then reduce our carbon footprint. But, you know, everybody knows that cows emit plenty of methane, and we have to look at our dairy operations here and our other farming operations and how those impacts, you know, are the greenhouse gas emissions. So basically, if you look at our forest land, that's sequestering a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere just in the forest. And then where you know, the other sources are would be, you know, the fuel use, but then also the dairy operation and the methane that and nitrous oxide that the cows are emitting. But I do like to draw a distinction between that source of greenhouse gas, which ruminant livestock have been and ruminant animals have been on this planet for hundreds of thousands of years, and the carbon that they use is part of a natural cycle. You know, they eat the grass, they digest it, they emit methane, it goes into the atmosphere, It's taken back up by the plants in photosynthesis, and it's kind of a 12-year cycle is what I've learned. If you follow one of those carbon atoms, very different to me than digging coal out of the ground and burning it and then emitting it into the atmosphere. So I don't want to sound defensive, but I do think that they're two very different sources. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be concerned with how we could reduce those emissions. And we have a plan here at the dairy that basically is a three-part plan: how we can sequester more carbon on the farm, how we can reduce our emissions, and then how we can, and then the third part, which Henry and I were talking about yesterday, which is climate change is here. The effects of a warming planet are affecting our farming operations, and so we have to adapt to those. We have to look at ways that we can make our farm more resilient in the face of these crazy weather patterns.
Wow. Hey, I've got a different multi-part question, but I'll just try to keep it down to two things. First, just curious as to when this very forward-looking, ambitious program to go beyond net zero came into play. And secondly, if you're aware of any other organizations, farms, nonprofits that are attempting to what you're doing up there at Shelburne Farm.
We've been working on this for at least 5 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Marshall Webb, who passed away tragically a few years ago, who was one of the founders of Shelburne Farms, of the modern not-for-profit Shelburne Farms, this new era of Shelburne Farms, he was very much a driver of this program with his brother Alec, who's currently the president, and we've been talking about this for 5-10 years. So it's really been part of our goals for a long time. And I think there are many not-for-profits out there who are looking at things like this. I think Wolfsneck Farm up in Maine, they have a similar program, and I think there's a lot of awareness, certainly in the not-for-profit world, about carbon and carbon sequestration.
I think some of the farms that were at the workshop where I recently attended with you, that some of those farms just personally were attempting to do that, to be carbon negative. And so you've talked about your woods. I know that you do very little plowing on the farm, and that certainly releases carbon into the atmosphere when you till a field. And I'm wondering whether you think your pastures are in fact part of your drawdown for the farm.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's part of that first part of the program. The sequestration is, this farm is what we call a grass farm. It's 100%, besides the vegetable operation, which Josh is growing vegetables on about 2 acres, and that's another whole conversation of what he's doing around building his soil and reducing emissions. But the livestock operations are all on a 100% grasslands. We're not a grass-fed organization. Our cows get some grain that we purchase, but the whole landscape here is all either in permanent hay or permanent pasture. And that's allowed us we've been grazing here for, over 40 years and haven't grown any corn on the farm since the 70s. So we've been able to sequester thousands and thousands of tons in the soil on the farm, in the organic matter on the farm. And we've had a lot of surveys, been part of a lot of surveys in Chittenden County, and our carbon levels here on Chelron Farms and or measured through organic matter are much higher than sort of the surrounding landscape because of the way we've been managing it. So we've already sequestered tons of carbon in the soil. But the thing about that is it's only temporary. So if we are to change land use, you know, start plowing and working up the soil, we'll start releasing that carbon into the atmosphere. So it's stored on the farm as long as we maintain this land use.
Right.
The other area that we're trying to sequester more carbon is by using what's called silvopasture, which is basically trees and pastures, and you sequester more carbon, not necessarily in the soil, but in the trees that are growing in the pasture. And so then it becomes important, what are you doing with those trees after, you know, they reach maturity? If you're using them for building and furniture, then that carbon is staying locked into that wood. That's why it's important to, you know, continue to build with wood and try to get away from cement and steel buildings and use more wood, because that keeps that carbon locked in. And there's a bunch of considerations around having trees in pasture. You want to have about a 30% canopy cover over your pastures, and then you also want to be careful of the varieties you select. You want trees like aspen or birch or locust, something that will let some light in and have a more dappled light, rather than something like an oak or a maple, which are the big broadleaf trees that, you know, don't really let any light in. So we've planted some trees in pasture to start some new silvopasture, and then we've also cleared out a lot of the brush in some of our existing plantations and forest land, and are developing those as silvopasture, getting grass growing in them and giving the cows access. The cows love having access to the shade. It helps hold soil moisture, and it provides good grazing even when it gets dry like it is right now.
Yeah. So just a comment about the methane from cows while they're on active growing pasture, that I've seen research that actually shows that a lot of that methane is recaptured right there on the pasture before it ever is mixed into the atmosphere in a significant way. So when you are raising cattle in a feedlot, you are generating a lot of greenhouse gases that you are not generating when you're on pasture.
Yeah, there's lots of benefits for pasturing livestock around sequestering more carbon, and the issues that you're talking about. Also, number one source of what they call non-point source pollution that's coming off of agricultural land is from erosion on cropland, and by keeping the permanent sod, you're eliminating that source of non-point source pollution. And we're right on Lake Champlain. We've got 2 miles of lakefront, so we're very not only mindful of, you know, greenhouse gases, but also water quality and our effects on the lake.
Yeah, it makes me think of a cover story, and I think this is an ongoing legal battle of another major, I believe it's a dairy operation that's on Lake Champlain that's had has been sued by neighboring landowners and maybe by the state for pollution into Lake Champlain. So you guys are clearly going in the opposite direction and being mindful of runoff.
Yeah, well, I think the farm you're talking about, they're trying to do the best job they can.
Uh-huh.
We have to also acknowledge the tremendous financial pressure some of these farms are under with our cheap food policy that the nation has. Of these guys are under a lot of economic pressure to produce milk as cheaply as possible, and they are trying to do the best they can, and it's just sometimes you just need to consider more than just the profit, I guess.
Yeah, and I want to throw another question, and that is your wealth of knowledge, of scientific knowledge about climate change and carbon capture and types of trees and type of grazing and obviously the cows. What sort of academic background? Are you just getting caught up on this in the last 15 years on your own, or do you come from some sort of scientific background?
No, not at all. Not at all. I did go attend the University of Vermont, mm-hmm. graduated in 1985 with a degree in animal science. I don't want to talk too much about myself, but I went to work one summer for the Foster Brothers farm down in Middlebury, Vermont. And I had been sort of grown up on a small farm and worked, you know, been working around farms. And that summer, the light bulb went off, and it was really, this was all I ever been interested in doing is farming. And I just have, it's always been really interesting, just all the different things you have to consider and all the things you can learn and see on a farm. And so I just have just been focused on that since then.
Did you work with Bill Murphy's pasture project when you were at UVM?
He just had started when I was leaving.
Yeah.
And when I graduated, so we didn't overlap. And then of course I knew Bill and traveled with him to several conferences when I had moved up here to Shelburne Farms, so I did get to know him and get to learn from him, which he was a great resource for the farm, for the state, and also very generous with his time to Shelburne Farms too.
Yeah, so it takes a community of people to have like-minded people to make things really happen, and that's I think you're swimming in the middle of that, and being a central point. I mean, the fact that there's such an education focus of Shelburne Farm really underlines that transfer of information.
We're lucky being so close to the University of Vermont, and we've been able to collaborate with them on a bunch of different research projects over the years, and have been really able to benefit from the knowledge that's been generated by those projects.
And you've cooperated in various little experimental research trials and things too, I believe, with the university. I know I was there watching the work of, I'm terrible on names, I know the woman, but I haven't got her name at the tip of my tongue, who had gone in and had right along the waterway that was right coming off the farm activities and right into Lake Champlain, and she had she'd taken out invasive plants, I believe buckthorn, and had reduced the phosphorus load because going into Lake Champlain from the land by having plants that picked up that phosphorus come back in.
Yeah, that's one. That's Jess Rubin, I think, is maybe
that's right.
Who you're thinking of.
Yeah.
And then we also, right here at the dairy, maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago, we installed what's called a subsurface flow gravity wetland.
Whoa.
Constructed wetland that's picking up a lot of the runoff, that's almost all the runoff that's coming off the dairy site, running it through a constructed wetland it's got no pumps or any sort of moving parts. It's just sort of a passive green machine, and that also helps scrub that water as it's moving off the dairy and down through into a natural wetland and then on into the lake. And all of those things help on reducing phosphorus and E. coli as it flows to the lake. But getting back to the carbon issue here, the other way we're trying to you know, other part of our program is reducing the emissions and how can we reduce the emissions. Currently, we're feeding a linseed oil-based product in our grain ration that's supposed to improve the cow's digestion and reduce emissions. Sort of one thing to keep in mind is the better quality feed we can produce on the farm, the better quality pasture, the easier it is going to be for the cows to digest, and the fewer emissions they're going to have. So we're constantly trying to make sure the cows are on the best pasture and we're producing the best feed. But also a big source of emissions on farms is from manure. And they're the two main sources are the enteric emissions, methane from the cows, and that's four times more potent a greenhouse gas than CO2. Mm. So any reductions we can get by improved, you know, nutrition and improved feed efficiency will reduce those emissions. And then the nitrous oxide is from the manure, and that's a 300 times more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. So anything we can do to reduce those emissions, you can get a real bang for your buck on those. And we're doing that reducing the manure emissions a couple ways. One is just being really mindful of how and where and when we're spreading. If we're spreading on, you know, saturated ground or we're spreading at the wrong times of year and the plants are not actively growing and picking up the nutrients, then a lot of those emissions will go off into the atmosphere as opposed to being taken up by the plants and used to grow. So we try to, you know, target most of our spreading in the growing season so that we're the plants have a chance to catch the nitrogen before it off gases. And then we've been using this material called biochar. I'm not sure whether everybody's familiar with biochar.
Most of our listeners are, as a matter of fact, yeah.
Yep. So we've been, this would be the fifth year that we've been covering our manure pits with like a 2 to 4 inch layer of biochar. We looked at, you know, how we could reduce the emissions coming off the manure pits. And you can use what's called a permeable cover. There's been some research done at University of Minnesota around different permeable covers. I mean, they'll let some moisture in and they'll let some gas out, but they'll trap a lot of the gases before they are emitted. You can use straw or wood chips or biochar. And biochar really, really works well because it captures those nutrients and it stores them within the structure of the biochar really reduces the odor coming off the pit. excuse me. And it also really works for us because we didn't have to change any of the equipment we use. It goes through all of our pumps and our tankers and everything, and it worked really easily. So we got, and then we noticed that it really reduces odors at the farm, you know, from the pit. So we're not smelling a lot of ammonia or other stuff coming off the pit, which is seems to indicate to me that it's working. It's reducing the gases that are coming off and capturing a lot of those nitrogen and the manure testing that we do. We've got a nutrient management plan so we track where and how much manure we spread and test the soil every 3 years, but also test the manure at each spreading event, and we're seeing higher nitrogen levels in those samples where we've put manure or biochar on the manure.
Yeah. Okay.
And then when we spread it, there's a lot less odor too, because there's just not it. And then we also think that we've seen higher yields on the fields where we spread biochar within the manure.
Yeah, not surprising.
Yeah, go ahead.
Not surprising. I'm glad that that's happening. It seems like such a nice natural, the biochar being such a benefit.
Yeah, yes. We were hoping to have some collaborate with UVM on some research here to look at some of these questions. But of course, the current administration is not as concerned with carbon emissions and that type of thing. So the funding did not come through.
Yeah, we know.
Yes, it's part of the evil world we're in. We need to let you go, and I'm really pleased to have you on the air. And my hat's off to you for working a cutting edge operation that is not only producing award winning cheese, et cetera, but is healing the planet in the process and leading that way. So,
well, you're very, very, very kind, Henry. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Yeah, Sam Dixon from Shelburne Farms, a farm manager up there, and a whole lot more. Really appreciate you joining us, and I'm looking forward to coming up for a tour sometime.
Yeah, and just for so everybody knows, there's no emissions charge, and we've got about 9 miles of walking trail, so everybody should come up and enjoy this really beautiful landscape.
And if you're feeling lazy, you can even get pulled behind a tractor in a wagon and get the tour that way.
An electric tractor?
No, yeah. It isn't electric yet.
Not yet, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
That might be something that's coming along.
Excellent. Well, appreciate your getting involved with us today, Sam.
Yeah, you guys have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So I've gone ahead and pressed the button, Henry. He knows that he can call now. So there, I saved you that.
Oh, because yeah. I was trying to find his phone number.
No, I got it. I got it figured out. We're going to be, that was great talk with Sam Dixon. There goes the phone right there. So we're just going to, I don't think we've done this in less than a minute, Henry.
Guest number two.
Advance. I'm going to bring this down to the mix, though, because I want to get to this before we bring on Michael Bailey from Solar Fest, which is coming up. Boy, it just starts a week from tomorrow. A week or two ago, we had a local poet in the studio, someone who knows you, because I mentioned you. That would be Marjorie Ryerson. And she read this poem, and definitely an environmental poem. So she left a copy for me. I thought we would squeeze this in between guests. This is called Giraffes Don't Buy Drano. Giraffes don't buy Drano to pour down their sinks, then sue their towns over poison in their tap water. Eagles don't wander the aisles of Walmart hunting for bargains, their high heels squeaking on polished floors as they smoke packs of unfiltered Camels. Chipmunks never send gifts to distant cousins by way of 72-foot, 18-wheel FedEx trucks that grind up interstates and down dirt roads, their engines devouring fossil fuels at 6 miles per gallon, their tailpipes gifting the air with benzene, formaldehyde, carbon monoxide, nitrogen dioxide. Chickens don't spend money having their feathers trimmed or their nails painted. Butterflies don't order toilet paper by the carton. And when did you last see an elephant drive his shiny BMW from Dallas to Portland? Or a suited-up chimp with diamonds in her ears fly Delta from New York to Paris to sip Calvados and visit the Louvre? A little poetry from Marjorie Ryerson. And now I think Michael Bailey might be hearing us. Do you hear us out there, Michael?
Hey, hello, Todd. It's great to hear you. Great poem.
Yeah, Marjorie Ryerson there. Maybe you'll meet her sometime. Great to have you on with us, Michael. I know this is, you said next week is Hell Week, but this week it's getting kind of close as Solar Fest about to celebrate its 30th anniversary at its new site there in Brandon. Wow, you must be pumped.
We are very excited. We're celebrating with, as we've done since 1995.
Yep.
Great music and informative workshops and just fun arts and activities for the whole family.
Yeah, really, really looking forward to it. I would like to start off, now, of course, I'm really into the music aspect, but let's start off with the multiple tracks of workshops, which are happening, I believe, every day of the festival.
That's right. We're very fortunate to have, we have multiple venues each day. So we have dozens of workshops. They cover the whole range from, we've got hands-on presentations, things like water wheel hydropower and building your own solar array. But we've also got some more practical money-saving type things like how to live better with weatherization and even self-built housing. There's the overarching issues of how do we live better and how do we work together better. There's some very timely topics, talks on things like how Vermont is responding to the attacks on renewable energy and even the attacks on the science of the EPA. So it goes from the how to practically do things today, saving money, to how do we make our community better and stronger.
Yeah, and I'm noticing that the one topic you just mentioned, that is Peter Sterling from Renewable Energy Vermont, a guest here on the show a couple of times over the years. And another topic that we've discussed here, it's great that you're having one of your younger workshop presenters, Chris Gish from Standing Trees, is going to be there on Friday with How to Love a Wild Forest, Current Issues in New England Public Lands Protection, just really kind of covering a lot of ground. Of course, not related to you, but Kevin Bailey, who runs a solar company along with Ken Oldred of High Peak Solar, they're going to give a tour of the Solar Fest power plant. Now, Henry, that one's right up your alley.
Yes.
He's probably going to be on that.
And we cover the waterfront there, too, from the solar trailers that are on a micro level, powering things like food courts and our solar stage, right up to the tracking 2.2 megawatt solar array that is on our western flank. So we've got a full range of power plants from all different levels.
Yeah, I was admiring both the local solar plant. In fact, is that done, the one that that SolarFest put together? I forget what the size of the one that we own is. Michael.
Our community solar array is 125 kilowatts, and we're probably about 6 weeks away from completing the final, turning the final nut and bolt to have that one ready and energized.
And what is so typical of the history of SolarFest and the development of that 125K is a lot of it is being done by volunteers showing up and mounting panels, you know, putting in the legwork.
We're a volunteer organization, as you know, and the people who make us strong, the speakers, the people who put the solar panels up, the people who are doing the zero waste, we're all working on it together because it is a community, as it has been for 30 years now.
Hey, speaking of waste, so in the sanitation, we just heard about a lot of bovine waste and how it's being treated. Some innovative waste technology being employed at SolarFest this year, right? P-Cycle coming up?
We will have P-Pods on hand, and we'll have a couple of talks about how to get pollution out of Lake Champlain. That's one of our goals.
Mm-hmm.
The P-Cycling, and we have a great presentation by the Rich Earth Institute.
Right.
They're going to talk about urine my garden, and how human urine can be very successfully used as a fertilizer for home gardens and also on a more commercial scale.
Yeah, and I'm noticing another one. I met this gentleman a couple times. I met him last year, and then he was a volunteer when we were working on the barn and putting in that sort of window system. Robert Black, an architect, is on Sunday, the final day, which we should note is a free day. Is that correct, Michael? People that can only make it on Sunday, they don't have to pay anything to attend.
This year we're trying to do something different in a lot of different ways, and that's one of them. You're right. So our Sustainability Expo Sunday, for people who haven't quite figured out what's in it for them and how they should approach this, it's free. We've got great music for Kotoko Brass, but we've got workshops and all the things you would expect at SolarFest. but it's completely free.
Yeah, and to just go to his topic, and he is a real intellectual, Robert Black, Design for a Sustainable World, 10 Principles You May or May Not Have Thought Of. Real quick, back to music. I just noticed about 5 minutes before we went on air, the Daisies came out this week in 7 days, and we're very happy to present, not for the first time. Ray Vega has been at Solar Fest before. He was voted top jazz musician in the state, and he will be at Solar Fest on Friday night, right before we show the documentary film about communes.
We've got the far out Jolly Lights award-winning film is going to be great. That's Under the Stars on Friday night. But as you mentioned, the music, we've got the range from the Latin jazz of Ray Vega to the classic Americana of the Mammals. Zach Nugent's bringing his Dead Set to the stage on Saturday, and the reggae of Kotoko Brass. And plus, we've got the return of our, frankly, the renowned Solar Fest singer-songwriter showcase.
Yeah.
It's been going on for almost 20 years now with the best and upcoming new singer-songwriters and talent that will be on our stage again this year.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to a listen. And, of course, that has been put together for maybe most of those 20 years by Rutland-based singer-songwriter Phil Henry, and he will be appearing with his band as well as another Solar Fest alumni, Lara Herskovich. So a lot of music, a lot of education, a lot of people banding together to protect our environment and lower the carbon footprint. It's so wonderful, all the work that you've done, Michael, and all the other volunteer work. I was just over there yesterday. I did drop off the bread and puppet materials over there in the main space of the barn. You'll find them there. And
thank you for that, because it's so great to have all the pieces that make Solar Fest the community, that art of bread and puppet, our electric solar-powered golf carts driving the musicians up and back from the stage. And the town of Brandon has loaned us their electric VW Buzz to be able to shuttle people back and forth to the parking area.
I want to get a photo of that. Yeah, I'm going to catch the buzz when I'm over there. Yeah. You know, they did change that law at some point about microbuses is what I'm talking about. All right. Hey, Henry, any final questions for Michael?
Well, I just wanted, for people who have never been to Solar Fest, I have attended once in Brandon and multiple times in Tynmouth. And I'm just want to give people a flavor that you can go and do these workshops or hear these presentations, but you also can dip in and out. Kind of music tends to happen more towards the end of the day. At least I haven't followed any changes in your schedule, but that's the way it used to be. But you can go back and forth kind of almost between workshops and music a bit. How early are music starting this year?
Thank you for bringing that up, Henry. And everyone can see the schedule. It's at solarfest.org. And so the music on Friday starts right after our free community dinner. The music kicks off at 6. On Saturday, it starts earlier with the singer-songwriters at about 11:30. And then Sunday, Kotoko Brass will be playing starting at 11. So, as you said, there's people coming and going. One of the problems we've had in the past is there's so many good workshops. Many of them we've scheduled to have more than once. So if you miss one because of a conflict with music or with another presentation, we have a few of them that are repeating. So, but between the food court and the exhibitors tent, we've the kids' corner. There's a lot of things going on across the 10 acres where we've got the festival happening.
And we should also add a new innovation, which I'm really happy. I've got to get my tent out of the storage space. Camping is available, and you can find out all about that at solarfest.org. Hey, I'm going to wrap this up by saying goodbye because you're going to see me again real soon, Michael Bailey. I do have the trailer for the documentary that's going to come on Friday night after Ray Vega's performance, Far Out, Life On and After the Commune, as we get ready to wrap up. Michael, thanks for taking some time and joining us here on the air today.
I really appreciate you having me in Royalton there today. And I'll see you certainly at the festival, if not before.
Okay. Thanks, Michael.
Bye-bye. Bye. Look forward to it.
Here we go. This is from the trailer. In 1968, a group of radical journalists from Liberation News Service left New York City for the country. That would be Vermont. They founded two communal farms in Montague, Massachusetts, and in Vermont. This story shows how the 60s counterculture transformed American life. Far Out, Life On and After the Commune.
The whole idea of moving to the farm was to get away from the cities, to get away from politics, to get away from the news. We didn't have a television set. We didn't have a telephone. We didn't have indoor plumbing. You know, we were going to start all over, like, you know, refugees from World War III or something.
You know, we were just kind of old enough to know that this was a pretty amazing experience.
Winter's done, but back to the landers. First blush of May is peeking through. Loosen the guy wires, come and meander. Climb up to our cosmic view. Tie a ton sheet to the maypole. No need to know what stories they tell. Lovers in transit, spin out of control.
So I'll bring that down in the mix. I'm going to turn off that microphone. There's a lot of red lights lit here. Once again, that film will probably be airing for you Night Owls after Ray Vega around 10 or 10:30 p.m. on the opening night of Solar Fest. Henry, you've got some more information.
Friday, that is, for Solar Fest.
Yeah, Friday night. Yeah, they open the gates for Solar Fest, I think, around noon on Friday. And if you're camping, go right over to the big space. It's great camping. I was getting my spot lined up yesterday.
So I just want to let people know that there are some interesting upcoming events on the subject of pushing back against climate change through art and community. There is an event here at the law school on Saturday, this coming Saturday at 2 o'clock in Oaks Hall. And there's a link to that, so you can see a little video of some of their activities in the past in the show notes. And on Saturday, August 3rd, there's Saving Walden's World, which is at the Woodstock.
I think that might be Sunday, August 3rd.
Excuse me,
yeah.
Sunday.
Sunday, August 3rd, yeah.
Yes, Sunday, August 3rd.
Jim Merkel's film.
Jim Merkel will be there in attendance to visit with people. And there's also some positive stuff. Bill McKibben wrote a recent a piece that is his kind of weekly newsletter.
Yeah.
And in that, he has pointed out all kinds of bad things are happening, and then said the International Court of Justice held this week that failing to protect the planet from global warming could be a violation of international law. And that countries that don't tend to it can be held responsible for the damages.
Yeah, 15 seconds to go here on Greens. And you got one more thing, Henry?
No, that's it.
All right, we want to thank Solaflex Bale, Royal Trailworks, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solaflex, the White Wit and Grit, and